thank you for coming today. And I would like to say how grateful I am and happy to be with you. Let me introduce myself. What does the official paper said? Who am I? Serja. Can you pronounce that? Just don't make these two American people pronounce it. They can do it in a very funny way. They normally say it's Sergi, but it's easier with you. Okay, my name is Serja Popović. I'm coming from Belgrade, Serbia, where I live. 10 years ago, I've been one of the founders and leaders of a movement called Otpor, or Resistance in English, which was one of the critical reasons why we succeed with our nonviolent revolution and turn the country towards democracy. Tomorrow morning, I think on this exact same spot, we will go through the screening of the great documentary called Bringing Down the Dictator, made by Steve York, and after that we will go with the discussion and questions and techniques and ideas about the nonviolent struggle. And today, my very specific task from my hosts, led by Phil Yugelov, you've met Phil? Yes, you know the guy? And he says, okay, you have hour and a half. Well, hour and a 15 minutes because there is a match going on and you need to introduce these people to the concept of nonviolent struggle. And I was sitting there and thinking how to do it because we have all these different types of work. Oh, here is the guy who is responsible for me being here. Thank you, Phil. And we were talking about how to structure it and what to speak about. And generally, my idea was to walk you a little bit through this idea and through the history. By the way, I'm coming from the organization called Center for Applied Nonviolent Action on Strategy. And then the canvas is the shortcut to remember this. And our job in previous years was to train nonviolent groups worldwide. And we've done a lot of work in some of the well-known cases, like Georgia and Ukraine and Lebanon, and also in some places we couldn't find on the map when the people addressed to us, like Maldives or Sierra Leone or Fiji. And all of these people share the common thing. They would like to learn more about how you build a pro-democratic movement, how you struggle more efficiently for human rights, how you run the campaigns. Behind all this, there is this one big phenomenon I would like us to speak about a little bit today. And this phenomenon is what we and our friends in academia, in the United States, in Serbia, are calling the phenomenon of social conflict and nonviolent struggle. And before we jump to it, I would like to encourage you to interfere at any point, raise hand, just stop me. I mean, the situation in which I'm standing this on this stage doesn't necessarily mean that I'm leading the show. In fact, the more you say, the happier we will all be. Okay? Okay, so has anybody ever heard about this idea, the phenomenon of nonviolent struggle? Yes? Okay, so what does it mean for you? Any volunteers? Come on. Yes? Okay, so this is one of the points. When there is this idea of nonviolent struggle, what is the first, let's say, person coming to your mind? Gandhi. Of course. Who was Gandhi? Who was this guy? Okay, I mean, who was this guy? Yes, he was a young lawyer starting from South Africa, coming to India and launching the Satyagraha, our struggle movement, and used to be very successful in it. Okay, what is another face or name coming to your mind when you mention nonviolent struggle? Sorry? Martin Luther King? Yes. Who was this guy? Okay, American Civil Rights Movement. Yes. We are going very, very well. Where there is another face very much around as we are watching this worldwide circus called the World Championship in football. Yes. Who was Nelson Mandela? Okay. Okay, so we will try to focus on this, and I will try to introduce you to this phenomenon. And God bless me, I'm happy with this, because normally when I appear on a conference, I face all different types of misconceptions, like, you know, we'll go through it. You have the small questionnaire in front of you. So let me first try to walk you back throughout this 20th century and see how the different conflicts operate. And then, in the very beginning, you can look at the world as a great battlefield. Do you know who this guy was, by any chance? This funny-looking Chinese mustache, traditionally dressed guy. Yes, this is Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu was the minister or the advisor for war on a Chinese emperor's court, and was actually the first figure in the history who was talking soundly about the importance of the strategy. And he also settled down some rules which you can use in the modern wars, in a nonviolent struggle, in business, in studying your faculty. And these rules haven't changed. The reason we are, you know, referring to Sun Tzu a lot is because we are looking to this nonviolent struggle thing as a form of warfare. And if we look throughout the world, we will see that the world is actually the pretty big battlefield on many different positions. It used to be the racial battlefield. It used to be the battlefield between sexes, male and female. It used to be, and still is, unfortunately, the battlefield between the religions. It used to be the battlefield about the ideologies. But the battle which is ongoing, on which I would like to focus your attention, especially because you're in a human rights conference, is the battlefield between two different approaches to the conflict. Okay. So, okay. There was a nice Russian guy born actually in Georgia, Yosif Vissarionovich Djugashvili, whom we of course know as Stalin. He used to, once he was debated about the Pope and the Vatican, and he posted the genius questions. Okay, this Pope, how many battalions does he have? This is the continuation of the approach of the war, which originally comes from his fellow communist dictator called Mao Zedong. Mao used to say that power in the society comes from the barrel of the gun. So this is one approach. And unfortunately, we are living in a world where this approach is so common. It is so common part of your government, of my government's vision of the world, that we still talk about the nuclear superpowers and nuclear programs and nuclear bombs. Well, guess what? I disagree with this point. Because what really counts in any war, in any conflict, is the consequences. Would you agree? Okay, so this is not about what is happening on the battlefield, but once the war is over, what you get there. So let me try to walk you a little bit through the history of military conflicts in 20th century. So as we all know, the 20th century starts with a which big conflict? World War I. Okay, so what was World War I all about? Why the hell were these people dying in different uniforms throughout the world? Well, nationalism, no, well, are you sure? Yes, it was all about colonials, colonial powers. You had the big colonial powers on one side who were very happy with having India and parts of Africa and parts of America, and you had two growing military and economic power, the Germany, the Austro-Hungarian, who were very unsatisfied with how much they take. So, of course, having my country in the middle of the First World War helped it happening in the euro, because you cannot have a war without Serbs. That's one of the lessons you need to learn about us. And it's nice when you joke about your own people, but when you look through the history, it's not such a pleasant thing to be happy with. So the overall, when you look at the First World War, you can see it lasted for 4, almost 5 years, that several of the million people died, that even 3 or 4 times more people die out of diseases, because, you know, in this wars, a lot of civilians die because of the diseases and different circumstances. So at the end of the World War I, what was the consequence? That one of the immediate consequences, yes, yes, indirectly, but what happened in World War I? One bunch of military superpowers defeated another bunch of military superpowers. At the end of the day, they just redistributed this colonial wealth. They pushed the Germany on the knees. It was the end of Austro-Hungarian Empire as we know it. And then throughout the time, that will bring us to the World War II. Well, mentioning the second biggest conflict in last century, what was World War II about? Think about consequences. Always think about the consequences. So World War I, we have colonial superpowers struggling around the colonies, and then we have the redistribution of the colonies. And of course, 10 to 15 million dead people. World War II. What was World War II about? Well, world domination, this is what we were taught, yes. But generally, what was this conflict about? Yes, part of revisionist conflict. What else? Well, nationalism, yes.
Money.
Money. It's always about the money. But not really. What was behind this big thing? The one thing we call ideology. Okay? We had three conflicted ideologies in the world. We have the liberal capitalism of so-called Western countries. We have the strong right-wing nationalist movements growing in Germany, Japan, Italy. They had different names, but they were ultra-right-wing, not tolerant to certain ethnical groups, very expansionistic. And then on the East, you had a kind of the socialist, communist point of view. So this is like you have three big ideologies growing together with growing military power, economic power, political power. At the end of the day, they clash. And then the World War II is over. We have some 30, 35 million dead or displaced people. And what is the outcome of the World War II? Of course, this is exactly what my point. So the two big ideologies, liberal capitalism and far-left communist socialism, smashed the third one by the military power. And then at the end of the day, these two are now in a permanent state for years and years and years, which we call the Cold War. And then we have all the military conflicts looking back in 20th century. You will see them a small, how the military people call that. Hans, can you help me? Proxies. Is this the word? These proxies of the Cold War, like Korea and Vietnam. All these places were just the small wars, which were the proxies of the big war. So when you look to the history and the outcomes of military conflict in 20th century, it's actually not very impressive. Now, let's get back to the guys we were mentioning, Gandhi. Okay? So what has Gandhi done? Except being a tremendous leader, moving millions of people, being a brilliant strategist. What is the thing he has achieved? He has freed India. Guess what? We are talking about the biggest colony under control of the biggest colonial power at the time, which was the Great Britain. And what was the consequence? What happened afterwards? In many different countries. Yes. The end of colonialism, it has a domino effect on different countries, whether by violent struggle or non-violent struggle, these colonial system has been brought down. And now we are living in a century where beside few very small islands and maybe one or two countries or occupied territories, you really don't have colonial system anymore. So when you compare Gandhi's movement to the First World War, you will see the more important consequence. I'm not positioning this ethical point of view. I'm not preaching that the non-violent way is better and let's sit around in a circle and pray. I'm just looking at the historical consequences. So the second guy you were mentioning was Martin Luther King. What was this conflict about, American Civil Rights Movement? Segregation between whites and blacks. And what happened? He succeeded in the United States. And then another guy we were mentioning succeeded like some 20 to 30 years afterwards, Nelson Mandela, on the last island of this type of behavior in the world, or one of the last islands. And guess what? We are living. What are the consequences of this victory? What is the color of skin of the President of the United States of America? We are living in a century where you cannot find such a small, lost place where judging people per color of their skin is not considered highly socially unacceptable. This is what they achieved with this conflict. So when you look to the history of these conflicts, you can see that they're very different among themselves, not only per means you're using, but also per consequences. So what really, you know, makes me confused is that how many books you think exist in the world about the military strategy and tactics? Billions. Every single small mountain unit of Nepalese army has their own manual how to behave in, you know, around Himalayan mountain. And when you look to the real, how many people have researched scientifically the impact of nonviolent struggle, the nature of nonviolent struggle, you will find like 5, 6, 7, 8 names. You know, Gene Sharp and some other people, people like our friend Peter Ackerman, people like Hans Benedict. You have one of these people sitting in this room. So this is a really big field to explore. So when Philip gave me the task to walk you throughout this field, I was a little bit shocked. Well, tomorrow we'll focus more on the how it operates in practice, but today let's jump to the examples. Well, after the wars of the 20th century, this is the end of the century, brings us to the very dramatic violent events. And these events are coming from the same type of opinion which tells that power in the society comes from the barrel of the gun. I'm coming from the country which has been heavily bombed in 1999. We had a terrorist attacks on USA. We have Afghanistan and Iraq. We have ongoing military armed violent struggles in Sri Lanka, Palestine. I mean, it's a long list. So we are living in a very violent world, nothing new. But what's up is the fact that what is the nature of violent struggle? First reason is, as you pointed, one war leads to another. If your group, your government, your ethnical group, your gang is creating a violent act, it uses as a perfect excuse for another side to use the violent act. So what you normally get with using violence is increasing the level of violence, and we call it a spiral of violence. Then second general thing on which I kind of disagree with the people we meet, specifically policymakers in different governments throughout the world, they will tell you, well, we need to leave troops here and there. Okay, we Americans need to leave troops in Iraq, and we Russians need to leave troops in Georgia, and we Chinese need to leave troops in Tibet, because this is the only thing which brings stability. Well, guess what? The history teaches us something else. Military conflicts repeatedly bring to long-term instability. This is the nature of the violent conflict. And then let us shift back and look from another side of the view. And I mean, we really love to quote Mao Zedong, and power in the society comes from the barrel of a gun. There is a great South American writer called Jorge Luis Borges. Have you heard of him? You know the guy? So he has the famous quote which says, "The violence is the last sanctuary of the weak." And that reminds me on the time, and probably a lot of you in school, you know when the boys are arguing in the school, So normally you have a more clever boys who are, you know how to tease others, and you have a little bit more shallow boys who just lose the temper and then hit this weaker boy. Well, I was among those teasing others, and I was always thinking, when you lose arguments and pull to the violent button, that is actually the clear sign that you have lost. So we cannot resolve this thing on the table anymore. Of course, beside the Serbian struggle, on which we will speak a lot tomorrow, and then Georgian Revolution of Roses, Ukrainian Orange Revolution, Maldives in 2008, there are a bunch of ongoing nonviolent struggles. And from our point of view, we like to quote the man we mentioned a lot, the Martin Luther King, who said that there is more power in socially organized masses on the march than there is in the guns in the hands of few desperate men. Our enemies would prefer to deal with a small armed group rather than with a huge, unarmed, but resolute mass of people. And this is true. Because if most of these struggles could be, you know, held on by the small, violent group of people, this is always a good opportunity, the good excuse for your opponent to use force, not to negotiate, not to accommodate, to try to smash you on the battlefield. Well, instead of preaching, let's turn onto the facts. There is a great study you can find and download for free from the internet. It is done by an American organization called Freedom House. Have you heard of it? They're doing a lot of democracy controlling program, but this is just very specific study. It treated 67 transitions which occurred throughout the world since 1970 all the way to 2005. It was published in 2003, and it was a role of violent and nonviolent struggle in this transitions, and you will find that the nonviolent struggle was the critical part of the transition in 50 out of 67 cases. And if you follow these cases long-termly, you will see that in the 5-year, 10-year, 15-year framework, when we talk about the very, very blunt things like free and fair elections, human rights, ethnical tolerance, free media, you can see the tremendous upgrade in the countries where the nonviolent struggle was the driver. And now, because you're starting to sleep, my question is why? Why do you think this is happening? What is the nature of this big national or local, but generally speaking, mobilized nonviolent movements? It institutionalized a nonviolent way of thinking. But even before, when you look to these movements, it always starts with a few, yes, but during the time? To the masses, yes. We use term numbers, because in nonviolent struggle, this is a very, very important note. What is the nature of nonviolent struggle? You need numbers to win. That's the key. That's a big difference between the nonviolent struggle and military conflict, is that literally you cannot win if you are the physical minority in the society. You need to go to the people, talk to people, convert people, mobilize people, make people act, train people, make people participate in the struggle. So guess what? Once you teach people to participate in the change, they tend to stay on this direction. So once this spirit of nonviolent struggle, and how the Filipino calls it in a very, very nice way, they call it people power. Once you unleash the spirit from the bottle, this is very difficult to bring it back to the box and say, okay, you people have done your job. You go home, now the new government is in place. We will continue the same old business as usual as the old government. Well, guess what? This is not going to work. This is not going to work. And this is probably the main reason why 50 out of 67 transition cases where you had a nonviolent struggle really brought to democratization and long-term stability. because there was a huge number of people involved in this change. And it also relates you to the second very important point to understand the nonviolent struggle. When a nonviolent struggle becomes efficient, besides numbers, take in account, for example, civil rights movement. Absolutely. If you are capable to bring white people to you, if you are capable to bring across this social distance, racial distance, ethnic distance, whatever distance you have in the conflict. Okay, we are talking about the civil rights movement. So we say Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King will really start winning when they have the white leaders taking their side. Whether these people were persuaded by the power of arguments, whether these people were inspired by the sacrifice which happened with many rock musicians and celebrities who stood behind the anti-apartheid movement after Peter Gabriel made his historical song about Stephen Biko. Other these people were just pulled in because of their self-interest. You know, the white mall and shop owners in Nashville, Tennessee, were actually, didn't give much about the segregation before the black students organized the long and crippling boycott campaign of those malls where whites and blacks couldn't sit together in a bar. Well, then they went to mayor and say, okay, politicians, something's wrong. We are losing money. The economy of this city is dying. Sometimes people get converted by the power of your arguments. Sometimes they get converted by focused, targeted actions which persuade them it is in their own interest to shift sides. But in both cases, you're right. You start winning when you step out from your own small group. Have you seen Milk? Huh? You remember the movie? Anything besides fantastic acting of Sean Penn in the movie? What else can you remember? Where it has started? It is about the most prominent leader of sexual minority rights, gay rights movement in Castro Street, San Francisco, whose name was Harvey Milk. You spend hour and a half of this. It's heartbreaking and educational. It's a really great movie. So out of those who have seen the movie, what do you remember from the movie? They started from a small store in one street of San Francisco. This is where they started, like a small free territory. And they need to pass through all these obstacles, you know, dealing with ultra-right in the United States, dealing with violence sometimes, being misunderstood, losing local elections, losing on a global level. But they were persistent and they were growing from their small victories. Well, I mean, the really breaking point in the movie was the fact that they accepted a woman to be their public relations officer. At that point, they start gaining actually the support of different people around the United States, and the most important part was they start gaining the support of the straight people. So this is the same old point. You are having the idea, but in order to make it vivid, popular, and nationally accepted, you need somehow to bridge across this social distance. At the end of block one, what is nonviolent struggle? What do we know now? No, I hide it. So how does it look to you now? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you use masses. It's not a military action. Yes. This is the definition by our friend Peter Ackerman, who really designed it as a called asymmetric conflict. So one side doesn't have military option. Okay. This is the, before we jump into the main misconception about the struggle, I need to underline this fact. Look at this. It does not have any ethical tag on it. Okay? We don't say nonviolent struggle is good, violent struggle is bad. We leave to the religious people this type of sentences. But as the practitioners of nonviolent struggle, this is how the things are. We didn't have any military chance against the government of Slobodan Milošević. He was controlling police, he was controlling army. Having an idea of arming and training people to oppose him was senseless. For God's sake, the NATO failed in trying this. Okay? So that was really hopeless idea to go into a military conflict. Well, this, you know this guy with the mustaches? You know who is this guy? Lech Walesa? Yes? Who was him? Oh, yes. Yes. I've forgotten this in my 20th century lecture. What happened in Poland? Mm-hmm. He started a movement about the, you know, rights of people to organize laborers. He successfully hit it with strikes few of the big shipyards, which were very important for the Polish economy. What military chance did he have in the 80s? There was 1 million Russian troops in Poland at that point, around 1 million, 930,000. Okay? So absolutely no military option for him. Well, we know the history, he succeeded. And what were the consequences of his success? End of Cold War, the biggest country occupied by Soviet troops, removed from Soviet occupation, and then, you know, one after another, the Baltic countries and here and there. And before you know, the Berlin Wall has fallen, and the Europe as we know is born. And it was all started by, you know, a group of crazy people in a shipyard in Gdansk. Sounds silly? But this is, you know, history is sometimes very silly. And especially the points of history are different, but this is very important consequence. Okay, so if we walk down the consequence, we mentioned India, we mentioned civil rights movement, we mentioned Poland, we mentioned South Africa. Also, I would recommend to your attention another great movie by Steve York. It is called A Force More Powerful. 6-episode documentary. Some of you has probably seen it on History Channel or History Viasat. Tells a nice stories about some other case studies like Chile. As we speak, I just counted a few examples. But I mean, if you turn the news on, you will see many of them. You have the more or less nonviolent conflicts ongoing all around the world as we speak. Places like Zimbabwe, where you have the failure of the opposition for years to capitalize the fact that they have the numbers. Asymmetric conflict in China. Complicated conflict in Venezuela. Heartbreaking conflict in Burma, which is where I go after I end with this conference at the border between Burma and Thailand to work with Burmese. And then if you look at the CNN, you will see funny flags with fist logo, reminding you on what you will see tomorrow in the movie about the Serbia, but these are, you know, waving in Cairo and Alexandria, because we have a very nice, brave movement of Egyptian students in a very hostile environment between the 30 years of state of emergency of Hosni Mubarak on one side and extreme Muslim Brotherhood on another side. Very difficult place to work as a pro-democracy movement. And of course, Iran. What do we know about Iran? Except it's in news at all times. Unlike all the expectations, it happened last year that we understood from the outside that there is a movement of well-organized people struggling for democracy there. In fact, that confused the opposition leaders in Iran themselves. So, I mean, the world is a very funny place. And in order to understand it, we need to watch this phenomenon and try to deal with it the best we can. But the purpose of this long introduction was to show you that this struggle is, you know, changing the world. So now I will point attention, because I suggest to work, do you need a break? I suggest to work without the break and end up like 4:20 if some of you would go to see the match, okay? I mean, just a suggestion. Okay, so hopefully two of your very nice colleagues gave you a kind of questionnaire which sits in front of you. I would like to point your attention to the list of serious misconceptions people have about the nonviolent struggle. So as the introduction was, what the hell is this phenomenon called nonviolent struggle? The rest of it will be what it is not. Okay? So first of all, what do you have as the first thing? It says nonviolent struggle equals nonviolent. Nonviolence. Yes? What do you think about this? Right, wrong?
I'd say both.
Well, not to make the confused, the fact that your movement is not using violence doesn't automatically guarantee that your opponent won't. In fact, it will. In fact, it will use more and more as you're becoming more dangerous. So one of the fair things to tell people at the beginning of the nonviolent conflict is there will be casualties. The freedom is not for free. This is the things, but this is the good point. Well, but when you say nonviolence, you know, you think about the lovely Buddhist monks, stuff like that. So the reason why I'm pointing this main misconception is how people understand this term nonviolence. What, when you say nonviolence, probably, what is your first what is the first person coming to your mind? Well, yes, the nice hippies. Yes, we love hippies. By the way, it was an interesting social movement. Okay, so what does it say? This is when you say hippie, you say this is a nonviolence is a more or less way of life or a philosophy. But also it has a kind of the religious background. Especially in the East. You've heard of it, yes? Relates mostly to Taoists and Buddhists and stuff like that. Like, well, I mean, the point with this question, whether it is right or it is wrong, is to distinguish between the nonviolent struggle or nonviolent conflict, which is a strategic, organized thing with a vision, strategy following vision, tactics following strategy, from a traditional nonviolence, which is more like the gaze to the world. What we used to say is that Gandhi didn't succeed in India because he was a peaceful man. Oh yes, he was a peaceful man. And he was deeply, philosophically, religiously against the violence. But he succeeded because he was a great leader. He succeeded because he was capable to drop down the strategies. He succeeded because he was capable to lead people, to recruit people, to train people, to catch his opponent in trap, to exploit their weaknesses. So this is the point. This is a very, two very different points of view. It's like nonviolence in the traditional way, or how they call it, passive resistance. There is nothing passive in nonviolent struggle. The reason why you have the Sun Tzu in mind is one simple truth that he discovered to the world some 2,000 years before Christ, and it applies to the conflict, it applies to your normal lives, it applies even to dating, okay? If you want to win, you must take the offense. You will never win in any situation in life by staying defensive. If you want to win a girl's heart, a new job, a good scholarship, a political power, the seat of the president of the country, you must take the offense. So, the point here is that nonviolence is something which is more ethical, passive, traditional, religious, spontaneous, and then the nonviolent struggle, as it contrasts, is something very rational, very active, sometimes very innovative. Do you know, by the way, how the Iranian opposition pulled together hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Tehran last year? By Twitter and Facebook, and whatever you look at these new media, even in the most censored societies, you will see the nonviolent movements always heading one step in front of the government. And somehow they always manage to do the stuff. And soon we will see that the era of traditional mobilization media is expired, because these groups will not need television and radio to mobilize anymore. There will be a variety of interactive alternative media. That's another point. When we were using text messages on the telephones to mobilize thousands of people to vote in Serbia 2000, we thought it's a new technological revolution. We added this tool on the list of 198 methods of nonviolent struggle. Well, guess what? 10 years from now, every single small company trying to sell you a cheaper thing is doing the same. So we will follow this evolution of use of new media in the mobilization. Okay, what is the second question on your list? What does it say? We've passed through it. Nothing but the passive. Next one. I don't have it in front of me, so. Oh, yes. This is probably the biggest misconception, because of such a nice, sexy thing which we hear here and there on the different educational program. It's a conflict resolution. So my question is, how do you see difference between these two terms? Nonviolent struggle and conflict resolution. In your opinion, what is conflict resolution? Mm-hmm. One, yes, partly. One is the instrument, the other is objective. That's a very good point, yes. What else? Okay, you have the conflict, and then you get into the negotiation / conflict resolution / process. And, of course, your goal is, as the title said, to resolve the conflict, yes? What is your goal in nonviolent struggle? To win the war. That's your goal. So this is very different. These two terms are very different. I would name the conflict resolution a set of skills which come at one point when there is a possibility for negotiations between the partners. But overall, watching nonviolent struggle and nonviolent conflict should be seen as a form of warfare. And if you are engaged into the warfare, when do you negotiate? When you're a kid, when you negotiate with your parents? Sorry? When you want something? Well, but what is the moment for negotiations you would pick if you're a kid? The moment when you bring your best marks from the school, or the moment when you broke the school window? Absolutely. You negotiate from the position of power. And absolutely no difference between picking the right moment for negotiations in nonviolent struggle and in breaking the school window. When you break the school window, you keep your heads down, you wait for the storm to pass, and when the storm passes, you behave a little bit, and then you ask whatever you want. You don't do it right after you have broken the school window. You don't pick that moment. So when nonviolent conflict brings you into the position of power, then you can use some conflict resolution skills as well. And of course, these are the very good skills for the whenever in these negotiations you need third party. So for the third party, this is the good thing. Is this clear? Okay. So what is the next on your misconception list? Sorry? Well, let's jump through this. This is clear. This is for college students. Oh, yes. This is exactly what we were telling about. So, what causes long-term stability? This is the big thing we were talking about. Okay. Why would nonviolent methods produce the long-term stability? What is the key? Have you ever been involved in any kind of demonstrations, petitions in your lifetime? Yes? Give me one example. Tell me one story from the audience, please. Stand up and tell me what it was about and what were you doing and what you achieved. You and then you, please, please. Okay, can it be ladies first? Sorry. You. Wow. Okay. So my question is, what when you were there, what made you do it?
Because you had a motivation that you wanted to change something.
Mm-hmm.
And because there are so many people that you realize how much power you actually
could have. Uh-huh. And also your friends,
yeah.
They're doing it. Okay, and how do you feel now about being there, doing that?
Great.
Okay, so your story. Okay, where? Oh, Tuzla. Okay. Okay, so what was your goal, request, whatever?
We wanted the army base to be given to the university for uses of campus, which was promised by the government some 10 years ago.
Yes, but somehow they've forgotten about this promise, as the politicians often do.
Yeah, we received the base.
So what have you achieved?
We got the base, but nothing.
Okay, but you kind of won. Okay, so my question is, how do you feel about that?
Happy in a way and unhappy because it stopped.
To turn the questions another one, if you were in Iran and wouldn't participate in demonstrations, how would you feel?
Like I didn't do anything.
So this is the point. This relates to these fantastic things that somehow participation in nonviolent struggle actually changes the way you see yourself. It's a really strange thing. And it's unexplainable to somebody who lives, you know, under glass and really never tasted the street or really never heard the sound of the, you know, police batons hitting the shields or smell of a tear gas. But there is something in it which makes you proud on yourself and the people around you. And this is the reason why this is related to the long-term shift in the society. Because making people participate, whether we are talking about one of the biggest case studies in the world where, you know, people who are not free in the society, which is not free, are demonstrating about the oppressive government who is publicly shooting them, which is one side of the story, or students in a small town in Bosnia demonstrating or claiming to get something which is promised to them, you get the same story. And you get it over and over. You get it from a brave Iranian female activist, and you get it from a bunch of people demonstrating about, you know, the new mine not to be built in their village in Guatemala. And if they are capable to stop this new mine from building, which is going to break down their roads, cut down their forests, endanger their environment. They have the similar passion when they get into it. And once they pass through this experience, even if they get arrested or wounded, their life is never the same. But in these cases of transition, we are talking about the millions of people who go through this experience. Logically, you have the million times bigger impact on this society. Now, this also brings us to another answer. When nonviolent struggle starts to be efficient, besides when the numbers come and besides the very clever point of, you know, bridging this social distance between us who are for this idea and them, what is the thing which will make you get involved into this? Was it something ideological or abstract or something very personal? Of course, but the part of the answer was my friends are in there, my environment is in there, my family is in there. You will not find in even the best societies in the world, the nice liberal societies with great ideas where these ideas are supported, you will not find more than 5 to 10% of the people who would risk their life, job, and energy because of somebody else's ideas. 90% of the people participate in this movement because they feel it personally. This is somehow related to their life, to their friends, to their family, to their job, to their neighborhood. Okay? Sometimes very small, selfish interest. But this is the strongest interest, because the nonviolent struggle becomes powerful where there is a little bit for somebody in it. A little bit for me, a little bit for you. So this is why we are engaged into this process. And then that, of course, brings you to the point. By the way, some of these revolutions we are mentioning and these big events like Serbia and Ukraine and Georgia are oftenly happening around the rigged elections. How come? Yes, but before the elections, you had the politicians competing. And then when government messes with votes, it becomes very personal. It's not about the politicians anymore. It's between me and the government. Whomever I was voting about, I don't want my government to mess with my vote. This is my vote. So these situations are often the very powerful emotional trigger, because people are getting personally angry. And this is where you gain the huge numbers. Okay, what else do we have on this lovely list? Right, wrong. Absolutely wrong. Most of the well-done nonviolent struggle actions you see every day in media are not to be related about the dictators. We had a huge movement ongoing. What is the only real nonviolent worldwide movement as we speak? Don't look at me like that. You are dressed as a spokesperson of this movement. What's the color you're dressed in? It's green. The only actual worldwide nonviolent movement as we see it in a contemporary time is in fact related to the environment. The fact it's becoming more and more mainstream doesn't decrease its influence. So whenever somebody say, okay, but you know that nonviolent struggle thing, this is, you know, for dictatorships and for the police, I say, have you heard about the Greenpeace ever? Do they operate only in dictatorial countries? Are these ships, whale ships, they attack somehow Japanese and we are talking about democracy? Is the Heathrow Airport in a Great Britain, which is, by the way, democracy. So, I mean, even the leader of this movement used to be the highly ranked politician or the vice president of the United States, which we, of course, consider democracy. So, lot about nonviolent. There is a huge wide array of things which are happening around the world where you can see the strategy of nonviolence conflict. One of this is, of course, the focus of your work, and it's struggle for human rights, ethnical rights, minority rights. And then, of course, something in which we are deeply involved, like is the, we like to call it struggle for freedom to choose. And then you have environmental movements, and also you have the interpersonal relationships. Your parents, your brothers and sisters, and especially your kids, will be the experts in nonviolent struggle. They are campaigning every day, sometimes with a clear strategy, sometimes based on their instincts, but you will see this type of persuasion ongoing around you. Okay, what's the next one on the list? Oh, yes. This is one of the great things. Every time you see the new bunch of participants, they say, okay, this maybe worked in Serbia or in Ukraine or in Georgia, but it will never work in Iran or Burma because the regime is too oppressive. Okay, so this is normally the first contact with these people. They want some knowledge, they want to learn how to do it, but somehow they think it will work only when there is a certain level of political space in society to develop this movement. Well, wrong. Skills you bring into the conflict are more important than the conditions on the battlefield, and you will see many examples of nonviolent movements winning against the very violent regimes. I don't know how difficult it is for a regime in Iran to arrest or kill somebody. I guess pretty easy comparing to Netherlands, but I know how I've been to black townships in Cape Town. And I know, I met the people who were mobilizing black people in South Africa in the situation where killing a black man was not many difficult than going hunting and killing an antelope. So, I mean, there were also in Chile, you had this wonderful Pinochet guy who would take the opposition leader from the bed, put him in a helicopter, take him to the mountains and kick him out without a parachute. So it's called learning how to fly, this procedure. So there were many cases in which nonviolent movements won against very oppressive regimes. So obvious answer to this misconception is to check wrong. What else? Oh yes, political space and certain economic things. There is this, a bunch of academics around the world trying to understand how this change works and how it relates to the national income and how it relates to the, you know, certain conditions. Well, the political space is never granted. Political space is conquered. And if you know the tools to mobilize the people, to gain numbers, to build from small victories, you would be capable to make yourself a wider political space. And it's same with the media space. Iranians didn't have the media space. Well, get what? They made their own media space in alternative media. And they made it successfully, and they used it successfully. So it's never about what do you have in the battlefield. It's always about what you bring to the conflict. So, also, there is the one close to the end about the oppression. It tells when you see the repression, the nonviolent movement fails. And it may look like that from the participants in the streets of Iran. But truth is somewhere else. Increased oppression from non-democratic opponent is a clear sign that you are becoming successful. Otherwise, he would ignore whatever you do. The moment you are becoming successful, the consequences will appear. The police will appear, the judiciary will appear, and the more regimes rely on what we call this coercive pillars of support, the more likely are they to fall, the less unstable are. At the end, leadership. Okay, you were mentioning some great leaders like Nelson Mandela and then Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and also we mentioned Lech Walesa. Is leader necessary for a nonviolent movement to win? No. It's a very good point, yes? Why are leaders good? Okay, you have this type of leadership program within your course, yes? So what's the role of the leadership in the organization? Motivate the others, yes? What else? Spokesperson, yes? Kind of rallying point about the people. What else? Yes. Sometimes a scapegoat, yes? Okay. So when you look through the history of nonviolent movements, you will see the movements where leaders were really great. Gandhi, everyday in field, strategist, negotiator, whatever you want. Martin Luther King, but also had like two or three layers of leadership. And then when you say Nelson Mandela, you must admit that he was a great leader. Guess what? He spent two-thirds of anti-apartheid struggle in a small jail island where he really was used rather than the symbol. He really couldn't run African National Congress from this small island and from the jail. And of course, you know, everybody was controlling who is meeting him and stuff like that. So when you look at the success of the nonviolent struggles, you will see many of them with no visible leadership. We don't know who was the leader in Chile. There was a successful movement which ended up with Pinochet, and we cannot put the finger on one person. Obviously, there was a group of people. Obviously, they were capable to develop symbols. But rather than having leaders, one should think about the symbols of group identity in this movement. My question was, who was the leader of anti-war movement, which we mentioned, started in Woodstock, you know, hippies around the world? Was that one particular person? But we still did have a movement, and quite massive one, and worldwide one, and with cultural consequences. So sometimes it's very handy to have a leader. Sometimes it's a big problem to have a leader. What is happening in Burma? Yes. Yes. Yes, but is she a leader now? Well, we hear from Netherlands, we see her as a leader. But when you speak to Burmese people, they want somebody to take to the streets. And this is same in Zimbabwe, same in many other cases. If regime efficiently isolates the leader, corrupts the leader, arrests the leader, kills the leader, bribes the leader, then leaders at some point become the obstacle to the change. And people don't want to be told that. That's the big problem. So sometimes, and also leadership is very vulnerable. You need to make the accusations and propaganda war against one, two, three persons. It's very difficult to do it against the movement with a symbol. So that's another big misconception of nonviolent struggle. Leaders are useful sometimes, but yes, it can work on a group symbols. Well, this is my beloved misconceptions. When we go throughout the world and teach people how to do it, they normally say, oh, we know you, you export revolutions. Well, the last misconception we need to deal with is, can nonviolent revolution be exported? Well, we know about how to export violent revolution. You know the guy with a cigar and a cap and a beard, Che Guevara? Okay, you know, you've seen this face, yes? You know the guy. What do we know about this guy? Come on. Somebody must know something about Che Guevara. But how come he succeeded in two or three repeated revolutions in South America within a short time period? You remember what we were talking about, the violent and nonviolent conflict. Now, let me see the army. What do you need for violent revolution? 200 to 300 strong men, well-trained, good plan. You block the airport, you enter the main TV stations, you put a gun in the head of the president, makes me concede the power to you on the TV, and boom, you go to another country. Well, unlike that, in nonviolent struggle, you need numbers. The real problem is that you cannot export numbers, because the millions of people who brought down Milosevic in Serbia are not giving damn about the political problems in another country, so you cannot just put them in the airplanes, bring them to Tbilisi, and change the government. I mean, I would love if the revolution would be something which can be packed in a suitcase. So you can really go through the misery places of the world, giving this knowledge to the peoples, and boom, before you know, they are free. The real problem is that people will take risks and follow only their homemade leadership, one. And two, people will risk and sacrifice only for the things they consider personally important, most of the people. And this is why all of these ideas and moves should be homegrown. Okay? So these were my points. And 20 minutes before the match, any questions? Uh-huh. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Where? Okay. Okay, so the answer is that I partly touched the first one. Of course, these two questions said the first one, the nonviolent struggle cannot work in societies where you don't have the civil society. This is my point about conditions. You don't have civil society, make a goddamn civil society. Make the civil organizations. Register them in the alternative space. So it is very nice if there are potential allies from civil society in the battlefield. It will make your struggle easier. But same as the media, if you don't have media, you create your own media. If you don't already have the civil society, you create a civil society. And then another one, which is very, very important, and I'm sorry, thank you for the intervention. It's like nonviolent struggle can't work in societies with a history of violence. Well, I mean, one of the living examples is standing in front of you. Somebody coming from the country with a history of violence. The more you are into putting this the way this works because it's efficient, and less you are focusing on, let's don't do violence because it's bad and ugly and let's sit around the chairs and sing, the better chances you have in a society with a history of violence. And you will find a lot of nonviolent struggle, the Filipino one, the anti-apartheid one, which did have the elements of violence. The civil rights movement in America did have an extreme wing called Black Panthers. And these people really believe if they armed and patrol the black townships, then, you know, they will do more than with a nonviolent movement. Well, the trick is how to distance your movement from these violent elements, because one single act of violence can destroy your reputation and your struggle within day. So, yes, nonviolent struggle can work in societies with a culture of violence, And yes, the best way to show it is to prove to the people that violence doesn't pay back. Rather than telling them that the violence is something wrong we don't touch, if there is a culture of violence, specifically, we witnessed 2 million people coming out on the streets of Lebanon during the Cheddar Revolution after Hariri assassination. These millions of people were equally coming from Druzi and two Muslim different groups, and they were all wanted to know whether or not Syria is a part of this. Within 15 days, the Syrian troops were pulled back from Golan Heights. After 30 years of civil war, you know, Lebanon is a synonym for civil war. There's like, at many points in history, three, sometimes four different ethnic and religious groups were immersed in this war. So we are really talking about this society with a recent culture of ugly violence, ethnical violence, civil war. But it worked. It worked. And it worked better than the violence. That's the funny part. That's the funny part. Okay. Yes? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So international, the international community is one of the four important audiences you have in nonviolent struggle. When you see the battlefield, you have the domestic public, which you need to shift to your side, including those who are supporting your opponent. You have the potential allies, which means all the organizations in the country. So nonviolent movement should work with opposition parties, free media, civil rights groups. And then you have the kind of the opponent, which is another point of, you know, touch. And then you have international community. The good news about international community is that we are living in a global world where nothing in the world can happen in the jungles of Burma, but because people, you know, do have these things, it can immediately become something the world sees. So the things are really toughly local anymore. They tend to become a little bit global. And of course, when the things become global, then you have the third party or the international community in it. It's an important player, but it is one of the most important roles to tell people to beware how to work with international community. In Serbian case, took us like years and years to cultivate international community in a way that it becomes the part of the solution of the problem, not the part of the problem. Bombing strengthened Milosevic, clearly. Because when country is attacked from the outside, everybody rallies around the leadership. Petrol sanctions strengthened Milosevic in 1992 because it made millions of people surviving day to day and push them into this gray economy where it is very difficult to mobilize people to do anything else except saving their families' lives. So when it comes to the role of international community, you can look at the array of sanctions, including military intervention, and you will see that this actually doesn't contribute the change. It contributes the problem. Threatening Iran by being attacked from Israel and the United States is the best news Ahmadinejad can get every day. Because this builds internal cohesion and keeps them on this island where everybody else is so-called against them. So when you look at the role of international community, on a second hand, there are so many good things international community can do. From telling people, giving people tools and knowledge, training, education, you know, which people are cut down in this type of societies, by helping democratic institutions to survive. If there are local municipalities in Serbia, for example, were supported for years by EU and US program, which was called Oil for Democracy. Because there was a petrol sanctions, but these municipalities were allowed to import fuel so the people don't freeze in their homes during winter, to the equipment of independent radio and TV stations. So there are a lot of things international community can help, but in the same time, the biggest lesson for nonviolent movements is never to always to have in mind that governments, foreign governments, they don't have friends. They have interests. So it's a very tricky position for a nonviolent movement, okay? We need to become supported by the world. We need to win in the international arena. We need to make others help our struggle. But the moment you cross the line, you become the puppet. And international diplomats, especially in these conflicts, they tend to micromanage. And in Serbia, we had like 19 opposition leaders. And for the years, this guy was the most beloved candidate for, you know, American embassy. And this girl over here was beloved by a German embassy. And actually, they contributed to the problem. It sounds silly, but this is how it works. So we really need, you know, to find this line in the middle. It's a very important point.